Having a teen feels like having your own live-in influencer. Somehow you know the latest makeup trend and the fact that skinny jeans are not the most flattering pants. Now it's time for you to show them what's up, thanks to Domino's. From April 22nd through April 28th, carry out as many large two-topping pizzas from Domino's as you want for only $6.99 each. And teach your kiddo that saving money and Domino's pizza will never go out of style. Carry out only. You must ask for this limited time offer. Valid 422 through 428. Tax may apply. Prices, participation, and charges may vary.
At Delta, we know Mike in 8C prefers reality TV to reality. So we provide more than 1,000 hours of in-flight entertainment. On the next flight, 8C is Mandy, a foodie. So we offer all types of food options. Because at Delta, everyone flies their own way. Delta, keep climbing.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
And now, prepare yourself for the only talk radio show you'll want to turn up.
Crank this thing.
Sirius XM Pandora presents the place where your hard rock and metal voice can still be heard.
You bet your ass, baby.
Unfiltered, uncensored, say whatever you want.
Hit the record button. Anything can happen, you know?
I know that ain't nobody out there came to be mellow tonight, now did you? I say there ain't nobody. I'll say there ain't nobody not out there that even wants to be a little bit mellow now, is there? Anybody wants to get mellow, you can turn around and get the fuck out of here, all right?
This is the Trunk Nation Podcast. With host A. Trunk.
What's up, everybody? It's Eddie Trunk, and welcome to another episode of the Eddie Trunk Podcast. New episodes every Thursday, wherever you get your podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you do not miss one, and thank you for listening. And as I tell you every week, everything you hear on the Eddie Trunk Podcast originated on my Sirius XM radio show. That's Trunk Nation. It's heard Monday through Friday live, 3 to 5 Eastern, on Faction Talk, Sirius XM Channel 103, or anytime, live or on demand on the Sirius XM app. It's also nightly re-airs of the show at midnight Eastern on 103. There's also a sixth show on Mondays, 5 to 8 Eastern on Hair Nation. A lot to listen to. Come on board and join us on Sirius XM if you aren't already. If you'd like to get a free 3-month trial subscription, very easy. No credit card required. All you've got to do is go to SiriusXM.com/EddieTrunk. 3 free months to sample Trunk Nation and Sirius XM either on the app or over your radios. Totally free. Again, no credit card needed, and you can hear everything going on. And then if you want to come on board, you can come on board and join us. If you're only listening to the podcast, you're only getting a tiny, tiny taste of what I do on the radio each and every weekday. So no excuse to not give it a try and check it out. If you're outside the U.S. or Canada, a great way to hear what I'm doing is through this podcast. So thank you for checking it out. Okay, so this week we've got a couple interviews for you. Both legendary British musicians. We're going to start with KK Downing, founding member of Judas Priest, of course, former guitarist from that band. He's got his own band now called KK's Priest, just released the brand new album, his second with this group, featuring another former Priest member, Tim Ripper Owens, on vocals. We'll start hearing from KK, and we'll follow it up with David Coverdale of Whitesnake. And you'll get an update from David as to where things stand with Whitesnake. And also, you'll hear from him about the reissue of a record he has coming out called The Purple Album, which is a remix and expanded edition of a Whitesnake record he did doing all Deep Purple songs. That'll come up second. We'll start with KK, DC second. That's what we have for you on this week's podcast. But we'll get started, as I just said, with KK Downing. Enjoy. KK, how are you, buddy?
Hi, Ed. Absolutely fantastic. Thank you. And hello, everybody over that side of the pond.
You know, we spoke last night on the YouTube show with Don and Jim. And at the time, you were in the middle of making a music video for the new album. And as soon as you finished with us, you went back to the set. Is the video done? How did it come out?
Yeah, fantastic. We didn't get out of that till about 3 a.m, but we had loads of fun making it. It was... And I'm really looking forward to releasing it. It's out on the 29th of this month, actually on the same day of the album release.
That is, and it's for the track Hymn 66, right?
That's correct. Yes, it is.
Yeah, which is a great track on the record. Who does the speaking part in the beginning of that song, KK?
Well, I have to say that I do quite a lot of the narrations on the album. And, so I quite enjoy doing that, you know, obviously detuning the voice and stuff like that. But I really kind of get into it, Ed, you know. Loads of fun, like I say. I mean, it's not, you know, you have to have a little bit of, you know, joviality along the way and enjoy yourself a little bit while you're doing this. And why not? Because it's such a wonderful kind of industry to be in. Well, for me, it's certainly my one more shot at glory, I think, Ed.
Yeah, well, it's the record. You know, as I was telling you last night and earlier, and I was telling my audience, the record to me, and I love the previous record, but this one seems like just everything went up a notch. Were you you conscious of that? You know, when you went from album number one to album number two to establish KK's Priest, what were your goals? What did you want to set out to do?
Yeah. Well, in all fairness, on the first album, I was kind of, because me being a great kind of classic metal fan, if you like, rock and metal, you know, I'm kind of the old school. I like that a lot, you know, Van Halen, Saxon, Scorpions, UFO, the list goes on and on and on, you know, Priest, Maiden, all of that. But and so for that reason, I think that I don't want any of that to disappear. I wanted to have a long life, you know, and I wanted to continue. And on the first album, I was kind of thinking, you know, I'm quite happy if some of these songs sound like that could be on Stained Class or British Steel or any record, you know, from my history. And I kind of like that, you know, adhering to the classic metal sound without too much saturation. And then I kind of did a bit of a U-turn, I must say, you know, on the second album, I thought, you know what, way back in 89, we decided to up the ante a little bit, you know, with the Painkiller album and just kind of lean on it a little bit and metalize it a little bit. And so it just become a little bit more intense. And kind of that was kind of in my mind when going ahead with the second album, you know, because these things, you know, you have to try things out. And like I say, it's kind of interesting to see what the audience is like today and what the audience adheres to. But it does seem as though, as you said, Ed, the new record, you know, from the people that have heard it, really particularly like, you know, the production and the direction of the new record.
And the thing about it, KK, is that you, in the decades you've been making metal music, and I said a second ago that I consider you one of the architects of it, you and, of course, Judas Priest as a band. I've always said I think the two architects of metal are Sabbath and then Priest, and ironically from the same part of the world and all of that, but I've always felt that. And you're in a situation where I'm sure in the few live shows you've done or the little bit of reaction you've had to this band so far, you've got people out there like myself who have been along for the ride for decades. And then people that maybe have kids and stuff that they've turned on to Judas Priest and they're maybe into some of today's metal, which is a bit different. So my point being is you're really, although I think the bulk of the audience are probably people like me who are old school Priest fans, you're probably also picking up on a lot of younger people and you're trying to kind of, you know, bridge and bring those worlds together. And I think you've really done it with this record in terms of direction.
Yeah, well, that's a very good point, really, Ed, because I know, obviously, since I kind of parted ways with the band in 2010, you know, it seems like there's a whole new audience in the decade that followed that, you know, and quite rightfully so, you know, I mean, the moms and dads and uncles and even granddads, you know, take the youngsters to see their favourite bands and inevitably the younger audiences, you know, can take a liking to it or not, but it seems like most people do, you know, most of the younger audience, they have a liking for this kind of classic stuff that's probably, you know, was put out there just before electricity or maybe before.
Maybe just before, like, maybe a little bit after electricity, but I understand what you're saying for sure.
Yeah, you know what I'm coming from.
Yeah, exactly. No, I totally understand. So let me ask you this. You know, I often find this interesting too. Like, if musicians come out of even the most major band, like I think of somebody like Slash when he was outside of Guns N' Roses making his own records, and countless other artists, they've got like, there's assumption among fans that, well, it's a cakewalk. It's going to be super easy for them because they were in Guns N' Roses, or in KK's case, you know, he's a founding member of Priest and all of that. But it's not that easy, is it? I mean, you really, in some respects, when you do a new band and a new project outside of your main band, you really do almost have to build it from the ground up again, don't you?
Yeah, you do, Ed. And the simple reason is the fact that you have, in the world today, you have brand names, names that have a heritage and a legacy, you know, like Judas Priest, Iron Maiden, Scorpions, all of these brand names, you know, and they're kind of etched in stone, you know, and people have been fans and bought into that and been to the concerts, and it's the brand name, you know. I mean, quite simply, I mean, with Judas Priest now, I mean, myself and Glenn, we're not there, but the guys can go and still out and play, okay, not stadiums maybe, but, you know, big places, arenas. Just, it's the brand name is bigger and more important than everybody that's in the band put together. And it's always been that way, and I think it always will be that way. So as you say, it doesn't matter what name I choose. If it's not a brand name that's not been around for 50, 40, 30, 20 years, you know, then it doesn't have, you know, the credentials as far as the fans are concerned. You know, they're looking for a band, okay, you know, impress me, come up with the goods, let me see you live, let, you know, you've got to pass the, to a certain extent, you know, pass the test of time with people. So yeah, it's not that easy, but you know, I think that I am fortunate that, you know, people do know me and my name and Ripper, and we were obviously in Judas Priest for so long, and so it's a little bit of a head start on most new bands, and I guess we have to be thankful for that, really.
What drives you to do it, though, KK? Because, you know, there are some that don't follow through on it. And I think of, for instance, a guy like Mick Mars, he from Motley Crue. He had never done anything outside of Motley Crue. And for probably 10 years now, he's made a record and he can't navigate getting it out, and he can't seem to get it together to put it out. Or a guy like Geezer Butler. I had Geezer on. He had started a new band called Deadland Ritual, and he came on the air with me. And I said, Geezer, are you going to really be up for this? Like, you just came out of Sabbath. Are you going to be up for getting in a van or playing in clubs or playing in theaters? Are you going to be up for that? And at the time he said yes. And then 6 months later, he left the band and told me, I'm not doing that shit. So yeah, it takes a lot to stick it. So to hang in there with it. So for you, what's the biggest driving factor to establish KK's Priest and keep doing it?
Well, several things, I think, really, Ed. I mean, the thing is, I mean, this is, I've been doing this now ever since I was a young lad, you know, and I've been on this wonderful journey, you know, this evolution of music, you know, rock and metal as that we know today. And it's been fantastic to be a part of it. So I think first and foremost, I mean, I'm really enjoying, you know, the writing experience now, you know, I loved being in the collaboration with Rob and Glenn all of those years. But sometimes it just got a bit kind of laborious. Things can go slow, you know. And so I like kind of being at the helm with it, really, and going at my pace. And I'm absolutely delighted to have put out two records in 2 years. But the main thing is, I think that as long as I think I can keep what I class as kind of classic metal alive, you know, because so many people say, oh, well, it's boring, you know, lyrics are cheesy, it's been done, it's all been done. But not the way I see it, because so many people now, they still enjoy everything that is from, you know, way, way back then, you know, early, you know, Scorpions, early UFO, early Priest, early Van Halen. You know, it's got so much credentials. So I'm just hoping to maybe inspire younger musicians to listen to these records and think, do you know what? This shit's really good. I like it. And it's kind of what I want to do, you know. So therefore, you know, just basically keeping the whole thing alive, because us dinosaurs, at some point, we will drop off the edge of the earth, you know, in mass numbers. But hopefully, at that point, there'll be, let's say, we've had the new wave of heavy metal guys, you know, and let's have a second wave and a third wave, and let's keep this thing going.
So do you personally, at this point in your career, I mean, we all know the story with Priest and that, you know, you, the band was going to end. That's when you, you know, were out of the band. We all know that you had a desire to come back into the band. They did not reciprocate. And then for you continuing to this, is this in some ways kind of re-energized you as a writer and a player? Because you were kind of, you know, for a few years there, not really doing this sort of stuff. So has this gotten your juices flowing again creatively? It certainly sounds like it, both playing and writing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I was kind of the, you know, the sole writer back in the 60s and early 70s. And now I've kind of, you know, before I had 2 feet, but now I got 2 feet and wings, you know. So I feel as though, you know, in some respects, you know, I've got that newfound freedom, and I can actually be the decision maker, really, and I don't have to collaborate. Like I say, we're a writing collaboration, you know, together, the three of us, and I wouldn't change anything for the world. You know, I'm so proud of everything that we did and achieved. But I kind of like to go at my pace now and just say, if I like this and I think that this is good and this is the way I would like it to be, it's kind of nice, you know, to be able to do that, I think. You know, it's like when you get let loose in your own kitchen or somebody else's kitchen, you can throw all the ingredients onto a plate that you particularly like. You know, you're just going to get more satisfaction from it, I think, you know. And that's kind of where I'm at the moment.
Did you use, is it all the same team, KK, that made the first album, Sermons of the Sinner, and made this new coming album, The Sinner Rides Again? All the same people involved in terms of the band and producing?
Yes, everything's the same. Yes, I'm the sole producer on both records. But like I say, you do a record and then you think, oh, you know, you're always striving to better yourself, and you should, really, because I don't think anybody gets out of bed in the morning and thinks, well, I did that and it's great. I'll do something else and make it not so good. You're always trying to, you know, make it better if you can. That's all you can do. But the main thing is, I do think that these two albums put together could make a great double album. It's just the production's a little bit different on the second album. It's a little bit more edgy, and I do use the term metalized slightly. But I like the character of both records, and I'm not exactly sure which one I prefer. But like I say, if we glued them together, that would make, as far as I know, a really good double album.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, you mentioned Ripper a couple times. Of course, that's Tim Ripper Owens, who was in Judas Priest, did 2 studio albums with the band and really kept the band afloat during a tough time. I remember I did a lot with you guys during that period. Tell me about your relationship with Ripper, because, I mean, his singing is tremendous, as everybody knows. But after Rob came back and Tim was out, did you maintain a friendship with him during all that time? And was he the natural guy you thought of to be the singer in this band?
Yeah, I mean, Rob left and, you know, after the Painkiller world tour, and which is a bit ironic, really, because I think the band was on one of its... we're on a high, really, you know. We were doing really, really quite well. But anyway, Rob left for such a long period, and then Glenn decided to do a couple of albums with Cozy and John Entwistle. And then when Glenn did that, it took quite a long time, really, more than 5 years. And we started to look for a singer. And we were just so fortunate to come across Tim, who was actually at that point singing in a Judas Priest tribute album band. And so we got Tim in. And, you know, we have to be so grateful for Tim for, you know, for keeping the band alive and doing all of those wonderful tours and the albums and live albums and stuff. You know, it was a great, great contribution that he made. But, you know, I guess the only reason there was an about turn on that really was fan demand to have the so-called, you know, what you would probably call, you know, the well-known voice of a particular band. I often say, like, Bruce with Maiden and Freddie with Queen and, you know, Jagger with the Stones. There is a voice of, you know, there are a couple of exceptions, you know, but to the rule. But for the most part, I think that that's what it was, because Rob had been so established for so long, you know. So I think, rightly or wrongly, it was thing to do for the fans, and we always have to think what the fans want. We have to consider them, you know, because otherwise we're in jeopardy of changing a natural course of history that the fans think, it, you know, potentially or realistically is the better option and the better and preferred route that they want. You know, we have to think of that. That's what I really do believe, you know.
KK, did you, I'm sure you did. Did you see the movie Rockstar?
Yes, I did, actually, in the end. I did, yeah.
What were your thoughts on it when you saw it? And how, was there any accuracy to it all at all, being based on Tim's story, joining Priest allegedly?
Yeah, I think what happened was, because the guys, I mean, I thought it was great, really. I mean, it was such a, you know, compliment, really, especially for Ripper. And they really asked us to be a part of that movie, you know. And but those would be thought better of it. And so we kind of walked away from it. And I think when we did that, the producers and everybody thought that they would kind of, you know, even though the basis of it, you know, would make a great story as it was, if it was told accurately, you know, in a non-fiction way. But when we weren't involved, they may well have been afraid of maybe repercussions of something, you know, if they didn't, in what they depicted as accurate or not. So they kind of moved the storyline away, I think, a fair bit from Ripper, in all honesty. And but, you know, I thought it was reasonably entertaining, really, to watch it when I eventually got round, just taking it on face value for what it was, you know.
Yeah, I did too. I mean, it still comes on TV here every once in a while in the U.S. on the cable channels or whatever, and it's always fun to watch. And, you know, you could tell there's some, you know, knowing you guys all so well, you could tell there's some, obviously some stuff taken from it, and obviously, just like Hollywood does, some things greatly embellished and going off the rails. But I had always, you know, I've talked to Tim about it, but I always wondered what you thought about it, you know, when you saw it and thought it was, if you thought it was rubbish or you found it entertaining for what it was.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been great to have done a really, really accurate kind of depiction of the absolute truth. That would have been great. But, you know, sometimes, you know, you can get a little bit spooked, because if it just doesn't come off quite right, you know, you could lose your fan base, because the thing is, at the end of the day, you're not in that editing room. And once you've signed some kind of agreement or contract to let somebody do the story, you know, and with no comebacks type of thing, you're not in the editing room, and so you don't have control. And I don't think for a band where we was at that particular time, don't think it was a good idea not to have control over how the band was how people made the band look in the public eye, you know, because a lot of times, you know, Hollywood is Hollywood for a reason, you know, sensationalism and kind of augmenting little details here just to make them a little bit more, you know, the old shock factor. So I think we probably did the right thing, you know, and let them just go ahead and use the basis of a story and embellish it in the way that they eventually did.
Right. And of course, since you ended up, you know, back then Priest took a singer from a Priest tribute in Tim. I mean, that's been done so many times now. I mean, that actually became somewhat of a blueprint and still is for bands going forward to find replacement singers in tribute bands. Famously, Journey, of course, has done it with their current singer and many others. So at the time it was looked at as kind of this unique fairy tale story, it's actually happened a few more times.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think the main thing is if somebody's really, really good in a tribute band, you know, they've got the chops, they've got the performance, and they've got the clothes and everything. It's kind of a ready-made replacement time, isn't it, really? So it's hard to resist the temptation of just copy and pasting. Like, you know, if the guy's that good, why not?
Yeah, KK, I won't keep you much longer. Just a couple more things, and we want to remind everybody again, the new album from KK's Priest, The Sinner Rides Again, is coming out on the 29th of September. You can pre-order it now, CD, vinyl, all the different ways you can you can get it and look into getting it. I've heard it. It truly is a kick-ass metal record, and I highly, highly recommend it. I got to ask you, KK, about the Hall of Fame, because, you know, I screamed and yelled about Priest not being there forever. As a voter, I voted for you guys. I shook the cage as much as I can. It was great to see it finally happen. It was great to see you be up there with the guys again. I had Richie Faulkner on this show not long ago talking about that night. He said wonderful things about being on stage and playing with you and just kind of, you know, trying to give you, you know, the stage as best as possible and just kind of be up there to, you know, support as best he could. I mean, obviously he was a Priest fan, so it was a big thing for him to just to be on there with you. How do you, looking back on that night and going into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, how did that all feel for you? And how do you feel the night went?
Yeah, well, you know, I deliberated. I'm thinking it's a long, long way to go, and because I'm not exactly sure how it's going to all pan out. But both myself and Les Binks, we were delighted when we heard, you know, from the management that we were going to be inducted. That was great. But shortly after that, we had another email saying, just to let you know that you and Les are guests of the band. So straight off the bat, I'm thinking, oh, here we go. You know, this is not exactly how I thought it would go. And then obviously we were kept segregated, you know, flights, dressing rooms, hotels, the red carpet, you know. So it was just total segregation. And that was it. But I'm really shout out to Richie. Richie was great. He came in the dressing room a couple of times. We had a good few laughs because lots of people were coming to our dressing room. It was good. Dave Grohl popped his head in because he's such a lovely guy. So down to earth, and that was funny. We had a few laughs. And it was great. Didn't say anything of the other guys, but, you know, there it is. But to be honest, once I got on that stage and I did it, I was glad that I did it because I think that justifiably, you know, I kind of earned that, really, you know. There was some energy. There was a lot of energy from myself and Richie because I think Richie was thinking, you know, you know, I've got to go toe-to-toe with this guy, you know, otherwise I'm just going to look like, you know, shadow or something. But it was good, you know, we worked it well together. And but I have to be honest, it just didn't feel like it used to. It was far from it. I think we had, we had two drummers and three guitar players. So that's one reason why it didn't quite seem the same as before, really. But yeah, it was fun. Like I say, I'm so glad to have that I made the decision to go in the end.
Well, and I got to tell you, from a fan perspective, which at the end of the day I am and so many others are, I applaud both you and Priest for doing it, for burying whatever hatchet, sucking it up for the fans and doing that, because there's been many times in the history of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame where artists have gone in where there's these divides in the camp and you don't see the other person. They don't go. They're not included in the performance. Sometimes there's no performance at all. I mean, I was pretty involved when Kiss went in, being friends with Ace and Peter, and there was such a divide there that nobody played. The band never played in any form, and it was just such a shortchanging to the fans being there that night. So, then you've seen other instances where, like Cheap Trick, who were having problems with the original drummer, but they still sucked it up. They brought Bunny Carlos out. They played as that band, and then they went their own ways. The way you guys handled it, at least to the public and for the fans, I thought was fantastic on all fronts, because that's how it should be. Because at the end of the day, that event is, of course, honoring you and the musicians, but it's super important to the fans. And the fact that you guys did that way, I thought was great, and the way it should be.
It was wonderful because it was a nice big arena there with probably about 7,500 people. It was just great to be in front of an audience again, you know, after such a time. It was really nice. As you say, you know, Judas Priest, we always kind of flew the flag for this genre of music and did everything we could. So it was right that we fulfilled that slot, I think, really, just to consolidate everything. And because the thing is, the other big thing is to try to pave the way for other, you know, such deserving bands that should, you know, be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame but aren't. So hopefully now with Sabbath and Priest in there. Mind you, Maiden were nominated the last time, just gone, and they didn't get in. And I was convinced that they would get in there because...
Ridiculous.
Correct me if I'm wrong, because our performance had so many more hits than all of the other performances, you know, individually. And I thought the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame might go, hang on, there's some good audience viewing here. People like this genre. We need to keep, you know. So I really thought that the Maiden guys would get in. I really did, you know. So, but there's always a next time for the younger guys.
Well, of course, they don't do themselves much favor because, A, they don't care about it, and, B, they speak out against it. So they don't really.
Yeah, yeah.
I doubt they'd even show up if they get nominated, knowing the way those guys roll. But they're doing just fine without it. But, yes, as fans, we'd all like to see them there. And I got to tell you, I think it was wonderful they included Les Binks, but I thought it was a travesty that they didn't include Tim, because even though the two albums with Ripper were, you know, not hugely successful, again, Tim came into Priest at a very, very tough time and kept the ship afloat, filled unbelievably huge shoes and filling it, you know, and coming in for Rob. And, you know, I thought, for a guy that made two studio records and a couple live records and was in the band for whatever it was, 5 years or so, to include Les and not include Tim. And again, it's not a band decision or your decision, I know, but for the Hall of Fame to look past him, I thought was absurd.
Yeah, it's a very good point, and we have spoke about it, and I know, I'm pretty sure Tim was quite disappointed, you know, for the pure fact that, as you said, that Tim was responsible for keeping the band alive, you know, throughout those critical years. And you know, Tim has paid his dues. He's, he's made so many good records, and he has to be the greatest singer. I mean, he's singing now better than I've ever heard him. I'm not just saying that because it's all there on YouTube for fans to go and check out. We just did some festivals in Europe and all that footage is out there. And Tim just sings out of his shoes. He's just incredible. So, but lots of good things ahead for us, all being well. Ed, we're very, very much looking forward to coming to the States, home from home, and doing some shows for you as soon as we possibly can.
Well, we know we'll have you on the Monsters of Rock cruise, which I host every year, so I'm excited to see you there early next year. Are you going to try to build U.S. dates around that? Because you haven't played yet in the U.S. Is that the plan?
Yeah. If we can't come to the U.S. this year, we were scheduled to play quite a big festival in Mexico. We wanted to put some shows, that's on the 2nd of December, in front of that and after that. But if that doesn't happen, we'll definitely try to do that around the Monsters and Rock cruise. Try to do a few weeks before the cruise and a few weeks afterwards. You know, obviously not forgetting Canada as well. And we're here. We're ready to go. We're just waiting for the promoters to call us. But we are filling in dates at the moment for next year's European festivals as well. So that's going quite well. So I think it's going to be very, very busy next year. You know, very busy indeed for us.
Last thing, KK, and I'll let you go. What is the best Judas Priest album? Give me one. I know it's impossible, but what's the best? If somebody is listening to this right now and never heard Judas Priest, and you got to say, you got to hear this band, what record are you giving them?
Well, you know, it's so, so difficult, isn't it? That one is really, really difficult. But I suppose if I had to disappear on that desert island and only take one vinyl with me, I'm tossing up between Sad Wings of Destiny, British Steel and Painkiller, and I don't know what's going to win, but it's such, nostalgia always hits big with me, so I might have to go with Sad Wings. But, you know, if I could take those three albums, I would be, and it's sacrilege not to mention Screaming for Vengeance and Defenders of the Faith and all of the other ones. You know,
right.
But I think from a nostalgic point of view, I think Sad Wings was the album that, apart from the artwork and the font and everything, you know, around that, you know, and the Judas Priest emblem around the angel's neck and everything, it just totally epitomized and just went so well with the name of the band, Judas Priest.
Yeah. Hey, I'm just thinking as I let you go, do you know something I will never forget, which I'm sure you remember, when you guys played for my 25th anniversary in radio, that private show in Times Square, do you know that was 15 years ago already?
Wow. That's gone by quick.
And the reason why I know that was for my 25th year in radio. And that means this year is my 40th year in radio. So I'm doing another party. It's going to be in Vegas in December. I know you don't live in the States. I know it. I'm still going to send you an invite, but I'm just telling you that what you guys established for me and did for me back then, 15 years ago, was one of the most special nights ever. One of the greatest honors ever. And I'll never forget it. And, it's amazing that it's 15 years ago and we're going to do a big party for 40 again. I'm going to invite you. I understand you. It's a haul for you, but still, sure. I wanted to bring up because it's amazing.
Yeah. If we can, absolutely just send us the dates and time and we'll see what we can do, Ed, but we'd love to be there. Love to be there to congratulate you on, the big 4-0 in radio. So, but that's, you know, they often say, well, I often say, Ed, there's no such thing as a young legend. And that's why you're a legend, buddy, because 4-0 in radio, that's amazing. But that's why everybody loves you. And that's why you are a big star on the radio. So well done, you.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. Coming from you, it means a lot, KK. So thank you. Listen, you know, I can't wait for you to see some live shows at the very latest on the cruise. I'll see you. And again, everybody get The Sinner Rides Again, the second album from KK's Priest. It is out everywhere on September 29th on pre-order now in whatever format you'd like. Thanks for the time, buddy. Always great to talk to you, and stay in touch, and we will talk soon and see you soon.
It's a pleasure, Ed. Don't forget to send me those details. You never know. We'll try and show up. Thank you so much.
Oh, you will get the invite. Thank you very much, KK. We'll talk to you soon.
Take care. Bye for now.
Bye-bye. Well, that second album from KK's Priest, even better than the first, I think. The Sinner Rides Again. Check it out. It is available now. And we'll see if KK gets over to do some shows in the U.S. He will be playing on the Monsters of Rock cruise, which I host. And looking forward to that coming up early next year.
Having a teen feels like having your own live-in influencer. Somehow you know the latest makeup trend and the fact that skinny jeans are not the most flattering pants. Now it's time for you to show them what's up, thanks to Domino's. From April 22nd through April 28th, carry out as many large two-topping pizzas from Domino's as you want for only $6.99 each. And teach your kiddo that saving money and Domino's pizza will never go out of style. Carry out only. You must ask for this limited time offer. Valid 422 through 428. Tax may apply. Prices, participation, and charges may vary.
At Delta, we know Mike in 8C prefers reality TV to reality. So we provide more than 1,000 hours of in-flight entertainment. On the next flight, 8C is Mandy, a foodie. So we offer all types of food options. Because at Delta, everyone flies their own way. Delta, keep climbing.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
As I promised you, a second interview this week also comes from a legendary British musician, David Coverdale, better known as DC. We will talk to David in this interview about the future of Whitesnake and if there is one, and also about his time in Deep Purple, which was started back in 1973, 50 years ago, and how he's celebrating that with a reissue of a Whitesnake record he did covering Deep Purple songs. Here's David Coverdale on the podcast. David, how are you, my friend?
Hey, lesson be old. Lesson be old, dude.
Well, let's just say...
Darling, why aren't I seeing you? I wanted to see your shining face. You haven't washed your fucking hair, have you? I know. Phone calls. How 70s of you.
I figured you had enough of seeing my mug, David. I mean, I figured, you know, we could just get it done on The Voice at this point, right?
Oh, no. Absolutely. Well, always a pleasure, Edward. Always a pleasure. I got food poisoning Sunday from orgasmic organic blueberries, and it's been quite the technicolor dream the last couple of days, but I couldn't resist talking to you again, my dear Edward.
Oh, boy. Well, I hope you're feeling well. And how are you feeling as far as the sinus stuff and some of the stuff that took you off the road? I know you'd been dealing with that for a while. It was quite an ordeal, right?
Darling, you should never ask a singer about his health issues unless you want an organ recital. Honest on God. Now, I'm not going to tell you what's all the stuff that's going on, but this aging process sucks on ice.
Yeah.
But we're getting
tell
there.
Tell me about it.
We're getting there. But let's get on to some good stuff, if you want, with this special gold edition. Have you got your copy yet? Did you get your gift I sent you?
I did. You know, it was sent to my address in New Jersey, and I'm in Vegas at the moment. So when I'm back there this weekend, I'll be there. So I have not seen it yet. I have a surprise waiting for me, I hear.
Yeah, it's really cool. There goes the surprise. I've got 200 copies of the Purple Tour book. And we're sending them out as gifts to friends. It's going to be on the Whitesnake merch online 310. They're beautiful books. Anyway, we're gifting you on with a signed copy and stuff. And I was hoping you'd have it. Yeah, it's really pretty. But we're going to, as soon as we launch the record, I think 310 is going to put it on whitesnake.com for people who only want it for Christmas presents. It's, you know, it's a beautiful book, holograph and all that stuff.
Well, I really appreciate that, and I can't wait to check it out when I am back east, which will be on the weekend. So let's talk about this record. I remember, and we spoke about this record, because the original version of the Whitesnake Purple album came out back in 2015, and like much of your catalog, you've done a bit of a repolish to it and added some bells and whistles. So tell us about that process, and for people who had gotten the record originally, what you have to offer them for this new reissue.
Yeah, well, number one, nobody's under any instructions or orders they have to buy it. This is something that felt appropriate with this year being the 50th anniversary of me being blessed with a job with Deep Purple. It's an incredible, you know, Glenn and I, we've been hoping to try to get together and just sit down and record our thoughts and memories of that time, because we're constantly in touch. But sadly, we haven't been able to do it yet, hopefully before the end of the year. But when I was working with that remarkable young man, Christopher Collier, who's also a Vegas guy right now, he said, "Oh, my God, I can't wait to get my hands on this album." I said, "Well, you know, I've more or less just done it." He said, "Oh, no, no. There's more to be done." So, you know, I went, all right, okay. So right now I have a whole new audio video team of young, hip gunslingers who really come in. And of course, your old friend as well as mine, the extraordinary Derek Sherinian. I purposely tried to make the original more of a two-guitar attack, because that is Whitesnake. But I didn't have McKaylee at that time. So while we were on tour, I asked Derek, and of course, Derek loves that early Deep Purple stuff. That's a huge influence on his playing. So that's a huge difference to what the album is. We've edited things, cleaned things up. I've done some more vocals. But it's the extras on this which are really, there's a lot more videos to the songs. What's being huge right now is Soldier of Fortune with Joel and I, and four members of the Reno Philharmonic, who have allowed me to call them the Hook City Strings, two violinists, a viola, viola and cello, and they just play the most beautiful, sensitive arrangement by Jeff DePaoli, the string arranger for the Reno Philharmonic. So that's really exploring the songs on another level. You know my feelings. Songs should be able to stand up whether they have a barrage of drums and electric guitars, or strip it down to that unzipped aspect. Songs should be able to have that kind of ability to be exploited in different ways and explored. Also, which was like a gift from God, I have to say, but certainly was a gift from my mom. My new guys have been cleaning out the studio house and going, "What do you want to do with this big blue trunk?" No pun intended, Edward. I said, "What big blue trunk?" No idea. So I said, "Bring it up." And like, it took four of them to schlep this thing up. And I'm going, "I've never seen it in my life." I said, "What's in it?" And they said, "I don't know. It's locked." I went, "You have my blessing to tear it open." And it was my mother's personal effects from like 30 years ago that my aunt had packed beautifully. So now in my studio, not only do I have all my platinums and golds, but I've got my mom's darts awards, which is just, she's got more awards than me for playing darts, God bless her. But I must have used her home address for the Deep Purple office, because I was traveling everywhere. I had no idea that she had, the Purple office had sent back my audition tapes with the Fabulosa Brothers, my local band in the north of England. I thought they were gone forever. And here they are, sitting there, pristine. I couldn't get my breath. I said, this is the key that got me the audition for Deep Purple and changed my life. And I called the guys, the Fabuloso Brothers, but first, not getting ahead of myself, but we played the setup of a reel-to-reel tape, and it was sounded so bad, all garbled, where it looked amazing, like no faults with, as you know, with analog tape. And we never gave up. We got in touch with Weta in New Zealand and said, look, we need a huge favor. You know how the Beatles are doing, whereas Giles Martin can remix albums that were recorded, they can separate sure. with this amazing software called MAL, M-A-L, but like the Beatles have got all the time book for this thing, and it's a bespoke software. So we had to search high and low for software that could decode compromised audio, and we got it to a point where it was acceptable for us as bonus tracks, and I sent them to surviving members of the Fabuloso Brothers, who could not have been nicer, more generous, and thrilled to be a part of this celebration. And it was fabulous to reconnect with them. And now they're inspired to get together every week and play and jam or just sit and have drinks and chat and memorize. It's just no negatives. It's just so cool. And we found a bunch of photographs that from in there, some naughty Polaroids, but what not to tell you. Hopefully my mum didn't go through them. But yeah, it's packed with all kinds of goodies. But really, this is just a total celebration. The remix is glorious. I'm thrilled with it. The alternate versions of songs that we have on there, it really is special for me. And it is a personal celebration of this remarkable anniversary.
Yeah, it's. I listened to some, you know, knowing the original record very well, I did listen to it. It really is like a whole new record, and the material is so great. Mm-hmm. The performances are so great of the people that are on it. And and then this extra, you know, this extra content that's been added to it is also very, very cool. You know, I'm curious, David, when you talk about that early audition tape that you sent in, because as you mentioned, Glenn is out touring and playing songs celebrating 50 years of Burn. You've got this reissue.
He's sensational.
Yes. But when you talk, that original early tape, take me through that. Like, you're a young guy, 20, 21 years old, and you hear about Purple, who at that point were already a massive global band. Did you find out to send that tape in for the audition? Was there an ad in your local paper? Were you off by someone?
No,
how did you know to send it in?
Well, I was a devout reader of Melody Maker, a weekly musical periodical, musical newspaper. And I was working in a boutique. I'd left art college because I didn't have a grant, and my mom was doing three or four jobs. My dad was on unemployment. And as I say, I thought this is unfair. They're struggling for me to get to art college and stuff. So I looked around for a job where I could actually keep my hair long. And a friend of mine offered a job in a boutique in Redcar in the Northeast Coast, where I proved to be quite a significant and substantial salesman. So I became, in the early days, the singing salesman. and I just had a guy come into the store, and I'm going, can I help you? I was reading the Melody Maker and put it down. I said, can I help you? And he said, hey, I know you, don't I? And I said, I don't think so. He said, yeah. You're that local guy who sings, aren't you? And he just cracked up, and he said, you should go after the job at Deep Purple, and walked out. So somewhat crestfallen, I go back and open my Melody Maker, and there's a picture on the top left page of John Lord, very similar to the, bless his heart, very similar to the picture in Monty Python, but with his clothes on, you know, at the organ. And the byline said, Deep Purple still haven't found a singer and are considering unknowns. I closed the paper, I got some change, and I went to a public phone box around the corner. I'm seeing it now as I describe it. And I called my local friend and manager, Roger Barker, another friend of Sadly Lost. And I said, do you have the number for the Deep Purple office? He said, yeah, of course, because he booked the Redcar Jazz Club and Purple had played there. he said, you're not thinking of, I said, well, why not? He went, all right, call me back at 6. So I went back to the boutique, and then Julie called him at 6. He said, you have to have a tape and a photograph and a small bio, you know, otherwise it's not on. Well, the only thing I had was these Fabuloso Brother tapes. And I got kind of lit at the demo sessions. Bell Records had paid for these sessions at 10cc Studios in Stockport in Lancashire, outside of Manchester. And they passed. They passed on those tapes. But I was quite lit. But, of course, if you have no choice, I got the permission from the guys to send this tape down. My mom gave me a picture of me as a Boy Scout, which I think you know is old news, because I didn't have any current pictures. and in my note, I said, Dear Deep Purple, as you can see, I'm always prepared, and my mom insists that she gets this photograph back. One of those things, you know, deadly serious. So as you can imagine, the entire world was after this job, and each member of the band or their assistants would go into 25 Newman Street, just off Oxford Street in London's West End, and come out with an armful of records, vinyls, cassettes, you know, tapes, etc., etc. And Ian Pace picked up a batch, which was the drummer, of course, and goes back to his apartment, and he stripped, you know, you can imagine they were bored out of their minds going through all of this stuff. But he played this thing, my tape, and he calls Richie, and he goes, I think I found somebody who might be interesting. He's got a great tone, but he's rat-ass drunk. which you can hear little bits of, as you can imagine, in these tapes.
And he's in a Boy Scout uniform.
Go on, Eddie. What were you saying?
No, I was saying, and he's in a boy, and he's got an interesting image because he's in a Boy Scout uniform.
Oh my God, yeah, but he says to Richie, and he's got a sense of humor, and Richie goes, what? He goes, he sent a picture of himself as a fucking Boy Scout. And Richie said, you're joking. He said, fuck it, let's get him down. That was it. That was the beginning. And they did, thankfully, send that photograph. As we later discovered earlier this year, Mam got that photograph back.
It may be, David,
seeing these things and hearing this music, it just relit remarkably vivid memories of that time. Insane. I just recently tweeted pictures of Scorpio Studios in Houston, Marylebone Road in London, which is the studio where I auditioned with them. It was unforgettable. And thank God I took the whiskey.
And it may be because your mom wanted the photo back, it may be why they also returned the tape, because they figured, well, let's put everything in one envelope and return it since she wants the photo back.
Well, the other thing that was in there was a tape of Psalm Studios or something where they'd run copies. Purple Office had run copies to send to the other members of the band. In those days, they all had reel-to-reel tape decks, you know?
Right.
So, because I couldn't understand, what the hell is that doing in there? I thought, oh, that's where they must have done copies to send out to Richie and all the other guys. So, because they all lived outside of London in beautiful country estates. But maybe.
David, what was...
Game changer, life changer, just astonishing.
David, what was the very... You said you went to that, then you got the very first, the audition, or the very first time you played with Purple. What was that like? Oh. And did they tell you immediately that you got the gig after the first time you met and jammed with them, or did it take a little while?
Oh, no. They took like 5 days. The band had pretty much decided immediately. And I felt very confident. Ian Pace took me to King's Cross Station, a first-class ticket back to the north of England. Are you kidding? This is a different life for a working-class kid from Saltburn. So I blew my 40 pounds of savings stuck under a mattress. I lived over a nightclub, and I'd be down there buying drinks thinking I had the gig. And like 2 or 3 days later, I hadn't heard a fucking word. And I'm going, oh, Christ, I better start making some excuse why I didn't get it. You know, I've been thinking about it, and I'm not sure this is my cup of tea. And it was like 5 days later, I didn't have a phone. One of my best friends had an office close to my apartment. his secretary comes running in and says, oh, my God, Deep Purple's office is on the phone. So it was like, Jesus. I ran down. My friend has a bottle of Glenfiddich. Whiskey plays a big part of my life, apparently. A bottle of Glenfiddich and two glasses to either celebrate or commiserate. And it was, there were two managers of Deep Purple, John Coletta and Tony Edwards. And Tony Edwards was there. Hello, David. How are you? I said, I'm fine, Tony. How are you? Fine. My God, Eddie, he's milking the tits of this thing. And it's like 10 minutes into the phone call. I'm sweating. And this friend of mine sitting across me at his desk, and he's going, well. He goes, oh, by the way, the boys have asked me to tell you you're in. When can you get down to London? That was the mind. That was the ass kicker. That was amazing.
Amazing. What was the first show? Where and what are your memories of the very first show you played with Purple?
Oh, it wasn't supposed to be the first show. I think the first show was supposed to be Aarhus, Aarhus in Denmark. And the weather was so bad, that was cancelled. So we went straight to Copenhagen at the original KB Halle. I think 2,000 or 3,000, I'm not sure. But I was used to play to 20, 30, 50 people or something, you know, in bars and pubs. This is a fascinating part. Not a lot of people know. We're backstage, right, before the show, and everybody's nervous. The manager's there. He's pacing around nervous. And I thought, I better get out of here. So I went upstairs and found a room. I had a Scotch and Coke at the time, whiskey Coke. And I sat there, and basically I was giving myself a talking to. Well, this is it, David. This is a make or break it. Don't blow it. You know, you're ready to do this. You can do, you know, giving this pep talk, you know. Meanwhile, all the band and the crew are searching all over. The crew are out looking all over the streets thinking I've done a fucking runner. I swear to God. And I was upstairs and I just absolutely have no idea. So I'm walking downstairs with my drink and everybody goes, he's here. We found him. Where the fuck have you been? One of them things, you know. I said, we're on. Come on, we're on. And that was, listen, I've got to tell you, it's vivid in my memory and in my ears. All the lights go off in the arena. The roar is deafening. I've never heard anything like it. And I can't see a fucking thing. So suddenly the roadies put on flashlights so you can see your way to the stage, stepping over cables and wires and stuff. And I walk on stage, and for the first time ever, I screamed, are you ready? And I hadn't planned it or nothing. And it was as if an enormous amount of butterflies flew out of my system, and I was off and running.
You know, David, I'm curious about this too, because in the music world that we're in today, it's completely common of so many bands to have lineup changes. There's even times where somebody can't play a show and the guitar player's guitar tech fills in. It's the norm now. Back then, 50 years ago, it wasn't like that. So here's Deep Purple with a new lead singer and a new bass player that's also singing in Glenn Hughes. Two major changes. Roger Glover gone, Ian Gillan gone, and here comes Glenn and here comes David. Were you immediately embraced by the Purple fan base, or did it take a while for them to get up to speed with the new lineup?
Well, I was more embraced by the actual musicians than the management. But Glenn, of course, had experienced some substantial success with been to America with Trapeze. In fact, right. I'd borrowed You Are the Music, We're Just the Band. You know, Glenn knows the story. Prior to my audition, because, you know, he was saying he was a singer and intimating at one time that he might be the lead singer. And, of course, Glenn's magnificent. He's my soul brother and righteous brother and the bluebird that I called him. Just a beautiful singer. And then I played, oh, my God, I played You Are the Music and went, dear God. I loved, you know, Mel. Mel and Dave Holland were going to be the blueprint of Whitesnake at the very beginning. But so I turned around to my girlfriend at the time, and she's looking at me. I swear to God, Eddie, like, I don't know why you're bothering. It wasn't the biggest vote of confidence, I have to say, but fuck it, it worked, you know. And, vivid red. I'm hoping I can grab Glenn and we can just shoot the shit, because we're, of all the members of Purple, he and I have just stayed in touch and supportive of each other. And I'll be promoting his tour that starts in February, I think, isn't it? I love him to bits. I think he's an enormous talent.
Yeah, no doubt, and still sings tremendously.
Richie,
well.
To answer part of that was in me, one of the questions I was asked by the management is if I was a writer. Now, the musicians I'd worked with in Rivers Invitation in the north of England and in Government and of course, the Fabulosa Brothers, they were so encouraging to me to write. The only thing we would do is announce it, say, oh, here's a song by Steppenwolf, because the promoters of these bars didn't want people singing their own songs, you know. So I have to doff my cap to my, you know, my former colleagues who were not only amazing musicians and helped prepare me for such an immense leap. But then I brought down to London and taken to Camberley, where Richie used to live, where he played me, well, we drank quite a bit. And he had a beautiful German, perfect scale, which I didn't know anything about. It was a perfect German bar built into his house. It was brilliant. And he plays me these Revox demos of songs he's been preparing. Well, spine-chilling stuff. And he, you know, he'd go, what do you think? And I'm going, fucking. So we wrote, a lot of the record. The big deal with Deep Purple was that each member brought an immense personality, character, and sonic. For instance, Richie, John, and I, pretty much, and Glenn wrote the lyric on, you know, We Had No Time on Burn. But Richie and I wrote a lot of that. But the arrangement, the rhythm section of Ian Paice and Glenn Hughes was just, they did that. I found a version, by the way, which I can't use. I can't put out there because I don't have any rights to it. But I found early versions of us playing Burn without that intro. Wasn't on there. That came with Glenn and Ian exploring each other. And it was, it couldn't have been better. And it still stands up, you know.
There is all of this comes out, by the way, that we're talking about. The Purple Album Special Gold Edition is available everywhere starting this Friday. Various configurations. There's CD, Blu-ray version. There's a vinyl version. And there's a ton of content on here, including the demos we talked about. And including, you have demos of material that you started working on for the second album that you were a part of with Purple, with Stormbringer as well, right?
Well, Richie, when we moved to L.A., Richie had arranged for me, you know, his deal with Fender was huge. And they delivered a Fender Rhodes piano, a Fender Strat. I've still got the, I think it's a Mustang bass, I'm not sure. And I'd make, you know, I bought the TAC 33S, which I still have. And these are some of my early efforts, because basically I just play a few chords and I play them. I record them now on my voice memos. I can't be bothered doing classy demos. And I'll sit down with my guitarist or keyboard players and go, look, you know, this is the idea, so-and-so, so-and-so, so-and-so. And then we explore that particular idea. But there were some ideas, as you say, for instance, is at the beginning of what became Only My Soul, which I never finished to actually present to the guys. I can't remember now, but there's some things on there that came later. But Richie wanted to change. Deep Purple had been a five-way split, probably seven-way split with the management from the very beginning. And Richie said to me, and of course, remember this, I'm the new boy. I'm still sitting at the feet of this great disciple, this mentor. He said, what are you, he said, I'm sick of doing all the work. He said, those are his words. I'm going to change the structure of this thing. And I have no idea what he's talking about. He said, what's your favorite two songs that we've done? And I went, Mistreated and Sail Away. He goes, okay, we're going to have Blackmore Coverdale compositions. Well, when that was presented to the band, oh my God, did the shit hit the fan. I thought I'd be on the next train and not first class ticket back to the north of England. But then, because of the way it was restructured, I became the principal writer for the next album and the last album with Tommy Bolin.
Wow, interesting. And so, why do you think, I always wondered this, I mean, we know that Tommy came in, Come Taste the Band was the final album with you and Glenn, and really the final Purple album for a while. But again, even with Blackmore being replaced, there's footage and video of you guys going to places like Indonesia and everything and playing the stadiums. Purple just kept drawing people, and still, even with major lineup changes, just kept being this huge global band. And we know Tommy had his demons, which unfortunately took his life in the end. But why do you think, why did Purple not make a fourth record with you and Glenn? How did it unravel?
It was being ripped apart by drugs. When I left the last, I didn't want to do the UK tour, the very last tour. It kind of got out of hand. You know, look at any stories of the 60s, 70s bands, you know, and the drugs and stuff or whatever, was just immense. It was just part and parcel of what you did. You had very accommodating Harley Street doctors who gave you whatever the fuck you wanted. And that was it. You know, Tommy developed some very unpleasant things. It wasn't fun. I did the UK tour as a friend, as the temporary tour manager, which I regretted bitterly because it was a shoddy tour. And at the last show in Liverpool, that's when I left the band. I turned around and I saw John Lord playing with his head down instead of his usual proud John Lord statuesque posture, and Pacey's playing with his head down. I'm going, I don't want to be part of the breakdown of this 3 years after, you know. So I buggered off and I went to my mum's house. I'd already got a little pub. So I went to my mum's pub and she was very gracious, and I was so exhausted emotionally by the whole experience, the whole 3 years really. But the last year had been extraordinarily challenging to any human. And she was very gracious. You know, I'd fall asleep in front of the fire. I'd wake up, there'd be a cup of tea there, a sandwich or whatever, and have a bite, a sip, and then I'd be back asleep. And she didn't push me or ask me what's going on. And then eventually I started to write my resignation letter, which took like a week, 9 days, something like that, because I couldn't really articulate that I was leaving this incredible scenario, you know. Things changed after Richie went. You know, you do know that the first one I put on the list, and I don't think anybody thinks, I don't like replacing as an idea, but a new guitar player was Jeff. You know, immediately, I didn't know him as well as John and Ian. And I said, well, oh, that'll be like jumping out of the frying pan into the fire. But, you know, I've fucking adored Jeff forever.
Jeff Beck?
The second one was Rory Gallagher, who I thought could have been
David, Jeff Beck?
Player. I'd open for him, huh?
You're talking about Jeff Beck? You suggested Jeff Beck for Purple?
That he was the first one on my list after Richie said he was leaving, followed by Rory Gallagher, who I'd known since Taste, and I was just a huge admirer of him, and he was a beautiful soul. And the third one was Tommy Bolin, who I'd just listened and enjoyed on Billy Cobham's Spectrum album. Now, here's the kicker, Eddie. When I'm standing with Tommy, like months later after he's in the band, we're listening to Spectrum at some party, and I'm going, oh, I love this lick. He said, oh, that's Jan Hammer. Ugh. 9 out of 10 licks that I thought was Tommy was Jan Hammer. You remember when you started to explore the synth, like sounding like a guitar?
Yes.
Oh, my God. I'm going, Tommy, come on now, I'll buy you a drink. So funny.
Hey, did Jeff Beck ever consider the gig? Did they offer it to him and he passed, or what happened? No,
it was never even approached to him. Yeah, Jeff was the first person. Before it was announced that I was in Purple, John Lord took me to an amazing watering hole in London called the Speakeasy. And I went down And I'm going, oh, what is this? And nobody knows. It hasn't been announced. And who's fucking standing there? Jeff Beck. Oh, hi, John. Hi, Jeff. How are you doing? He said, here, Jeff, this is David Coverdale. And I'm like, fuck, Jeff Beck. Huge fan. And have been before that, you know, since I first heard him in the Yardbirds. But he sits his hand out. He goes, oh, congratulations, mate. And I went, fucking hell, I'm shaking Jeff's hand. Next, I'm having a pee. There's no cell phones, no phones there. I'm in this small men's room, and Ginger Baker walks in, bumps his head against the bathroom, and starts talking incomprehensible Cockney to me. Once again, unforgettable. And I was with Jeff the last night of his show, and it was beautiful. He said to me, you've always said you'd be there for me if I needed you. This was the last night with him and John of the tour. He said, does that still stand? I said, abso-fucking-lutely. And he went, okay. And a couple of weeks later, a mutual acquaintance said, why don't you do a Japanese tour with Jeff? And I said, well, Jeff and I talked about that years ago. Is he up for it? You know, because I was still recovering from that sinus stuff. And then the next thing, of course, Jeff passes, which was, you know, still very profoundly deep in me.
Yeah, yeah, no doubt. Yes,
but yeah,
indeed.
So he didn't have a clue. I think I probably told him over a drink years later, and he went, oh, that would have been fun, or whatever. Jeff was just a fucking great guy, you know. Rory never knew. I'm not sure if I must have talked about it in interviews, because Rory, I bumped into him in Musicland Studios. He was actually working with Roger Glover at the time, and we sat and talked and stuff. It was just lovely. He was a beautiful soul, Rory, and a superb player. And being Irish helps, of course.
But, hey, David, I won't keep
Tommy. That's a whole new story. Whenever we have an opportunity, I'll regale you with his audition. Good God, it was amazing.
Yeah, and he's got his fans as well, and tragically no longer with us either. You know, David, I could talk to you forever about this stuff, because it's your recollection of it and the stories are phenomenal. And it brings me, and I won't keep you much longer, but it brings me to an obvious question here. As you paint these scenes, and it's so awesome to hear these stories from you, have you ever thought of doing a book? Have you ever thought of doing an autobiography and laying all this out? I mean, it would be an amazing read.
Well, I think How White Was My Snake? maybe a contender. But I've been talking with my head of creative, Peyton Murphy. We have some, and his assistant, Aiden Melendez. And we have some really, really fun ideas. You know, can I just slip back into one of your questions earlier? How did it feel hearing those Fabulosa Brother things? When you listen to them, you can hear my Stevie Marriott influence on a lot of the high stuff I go for. A lot of people miss that in my, but that was Stevie Marriott and the Small Faces, more so than Humble Pie, was a huge influence on me when I realized how to project my voice. And I can hear some of Stevie, which is such a pleasure to be reminded of that, because I adored. I saw Stevie paying off his bar bill at a club David Krebs owned in New York. I watched the show with Christopher Reeves, who looked just like fucking Clark Kent and was so adorable. Such a sweetheart. Another tragic loss, you know.
But
yeah,
for sure.
It's an incredible 50 years. It's mind-blowing that it's so vividly clear for me. And I'm so proud of Reb and Joel and Sherinian and Tommy and Michael Devin. You know, they just brought it and played with. Nobody's competing with Richie or Glenn or anything. It's just them playing their asses off on really good songs that have stood the test of 50 years, you know. I'm so proud of the guys. So proud of them.
Phenomenal players, and I can say I would love a David Coverdale book autobiography of all these stories in great detail. I hope you can get that together. I'll leave you with this, DC. Again, this album is out on Friday. Everybody check it out. Even if you have the previous version of the record, this is a whole new thing, and it's really, really cool. Final thing, David, what can you tell us about your status and Whitesnake? I mean, is Whitesnake, are you still going to try to do something with Whitesnake? Are you going to try to resume the farewell tour you were on, or have you really kind of put it to bed? What are your thoughts?
Well, I'm still having my band and I are in touch all the time. There is still a Whitesnake, and there are still offers coming. I can't entertain anything until I get my physical aspect together. You know, I'm supposed to. I had a fall recently, which I don't think helped my. I've got two torn rotator cuffs, which would certainly compromise my performance. But, you know, arthritis, all these kind of stuff's kicking in. You know, my heart goes out to Stephen after the cancellation. It's so awful to getting older and having this burden of responsibility to be try to be as good as you can. So, you know, you don't disappoint anybody, Edward, you know. And I know how he feels, and I send my love to him through our friends, mutual friends. But I can't commit to anything until I know how my health is. The last thing I want to do is go on tour and have to do what happened last year, which was, you know, come home, tail between my legs. It was heartbreaking. And being sick for a year didn't really help matters. But, you know, I've stayed busy with my amazing new team of hooligans, Hook City Hooligans. And my band are there for me. Bless them as I am for them. I love them dearly. Tanya's supposed to be coming up to do cook for Cindy and I for her Highway to Health show, which is always worth it. She's a super, super soul, an amazing ambassador for a home country of Ireland, and an absolute doll, a delight to work with, and a seriously powerful musician. I was recommending Mr. Johnny Depp for the Vampires, but he said, I think we have someone. I said, well, I give it a go. She's beautiful.
Yeah. Well, I hope we get a chance to see another run with Whitesnake, but I agree with you.
Well,
we
all want to know, Edward. You'll be the first. Well, the band will be the first to know, but you'll be the first to know.
Well, again, and I agree with
releasing them from my. Sorry, Danny.
No, I was going to say, and I agree with you completely, though, as a fan, you want it to be right. You want it to be good. You want everybody to be in the right place if you're going to do it. But you're still a kid, DC. You still got a lot of life left in you. You can get it back out there again.
It's horrifying to be experiencing some of these mortal aspects.
Hey, we're all there.
It's not my bag, you know, and it's starting to get cold again. So my knees are going. My knees, the titanium buggers, are like barometers. As it gets colder, it becomes a little interesting trying to cut a rug with my wife. But, I think there's life in the old snake yet, and that's my plan. I'm just going to do the best I can, as I've always done. And I always appreciate your support. And as I say, Edward, my love to you and your team and your family, and stay safe and well out there. And enjoy Vegas.
Thank you, David. Best to you and the family as well. Always great to talk to you. You know where to get me. And I hope you can make my event in December. I sent you the invite. I'd love to see you if you can make it.
I do hope. There may be a family trip going on, but I'll be in touch with you to let you know what's happening.
Family trip to Vegas. What's better than that?
No, London. That's where my two granddaughters, they're both going to, my eldest granddaughter's at Cambridge University, Edward. They're amazing.
Oh,
exactly like
amazing.
Their mom, beauty and brains, you know, and Cindy has yet to meet our little Baron, August. I've met him a few times, but because of COVID, of course, they didn't travel the Atlantic. So this will be the first time for Cindy to meet her grandson. I'm so excited.
Fantastic. Well, enjoy the family, enjoy the time, and everybody check out the special edition of the Purple album. It is out this Friday in all configurations. All the best, David. I'll talk to you soon, buddy.
God bless, darling. Cheers, Edward. Bye-bye.
See you. Well, always good to speak to DC. And that book he was talking about sending me, or the gift or whatever, still hasn't arrived, but I let him know they actually sent it to the wrong address. I think somebody in New York ended up with it at our studio. But regardless, the thought that counts. So thank you to David. And check out the reissue remix of the Purple album. Also, thanks earlier to KK Downing, former guitarist of Judas Priest. His latest record out now as well with KK's Priest. Thank you all for listening to the Eddie Trunk Podcast. Again, new episodes every Thursday. And please come on board and join me for my radio show every day on Sirius XM, Channel 103, live daily, 3 to 5 Eastern, for Trunk Nation, or anytime on the Sirius XM app. Again, free trial subscription, SiriusXM.com/EddieTrunk, 3 free months, no credit card required. Be sure to follow me on social media, at Eddie Trunk, Twitter or X, Facebook page, and Instagram. EddieTrunk.com is the website. Have yourselves a great week, everybody. Hope you catch me on the radio, if not back here next Thursday for another new podcast.
Having a team feels like having your own live-in influencer. Somehow you know the latest makeup trend and the fact that skinny jeans are not the most flattering pants. Now it's time for you to show them what's up, thanks to Domino's. From April 22nd through April 28th, carry out as many large two-topping pizzas from Domino's as you want for only $6.99 each. And teach your kiddo that saving money and Domino's pizza will never go out of style. Carry out only. You must ask for this limited time offer. Valid 422 through 428. Tax may apply. Prices, participation, and charges may vary.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.